compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to the program. Thanks for tuning in. And thanks in advance for calling this number, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. And we have lines open right now, which is great, so take advantage. I want to share with you a reflection that is attributed to Pope Benedict XVI. It's on All Souls, the celebration that we just had yesterday, the Feast of All Souls. As you remember, All Saints Day, November the 1st, is the day that we commemorate all those men, women, boys, and girls who lived lives of sanctity, perhaps died as martyrs, or for some other reason, they attained to sainthood. And they're in heaven, and we celebrate them on the 1st of November. And on the 2nd of November, yesterday, we celebrate All Souls Day, which is all the rest of us, and in particular, those who are in purgatory and who need our prayers. So I ran across a reflection from Pope Benedict XVI. I'm afraid I was not able to determine exactly the source of this, as in which book it might have come from, or perhaps it was an address that he gave. So with that proviso, I just want to share this with you verbatim, because I think it's very helpful to think about the time that we're in right now, as far as remembering those who have passed on, and why it's so important, not just now, but always, to pray for them. So here it goes. This is from Pope Benedict XVI on All Souls, and this is courtesy of a website called Catholic Arena. During these days, we go to the cemetery to pray for the loved ones who have left us, as it were, paying a visit to show them once more our love, to feel them still close, remembering also an article of the Creed. In the communion of saints, there is a close bond between we who are still walking here upon the earth and those many brothers and sisters who have already entered eternity. Human beings have always cared for their dead and sought to give them a sort of second life through attention, care, and affection. In a way, we want to preserve their experience of life, and paradoxically, by looking at their graves, before which countless memories return, we discover how they lived and what they loved, what they feared, and what they hoped for, and what they hated. They are almost a mirror of their world. Why is this so? Because despite the fact that death is an almost forbidden subject in our society, and that there is a continuous attempt to banish the thought of it from our minds, death touches each of us. It touches mankind of every age and every place. And before this mystery, we all, even unconsciously, search for something to give us hope, a sign that might bring up consolation, open up some horizon, offer us a future once more. The road to death, in reality, is a way of hope, and it passes through our cemeteries, just as can be read on the tombstones, and fulfills a journey marked by the hope of eternity. Yet we wonder, why do we feel fear before death? Why has humanity, for the most part, never resigned itself to the belief that beyond life there is something, there is simply nothing? I would say that there are multiple answers. We are afraid of death because we are afraid of that nothingness, of leaving this world for something we don't know, something unknown to us. And then there is a sense of rejection in us because we cannot accept that all that is beautiful and great, realized during a lifetime, should be suddenly erased, should fall into the abyss of nothingness. Above all, we feel that love calls and asks for eternity, and it is impossible to accept that it is destroyed by death in an instant. Furthermore, we fear in the face of death because we find ourselves approaching the end of our lives. There is a perception that our actions will be judged, the way in which we have lived our lives, above all, those moments of darkness which we often skillfully remove or try to remove from our consciences. I would say that precisely the question of judgment often underlies man of all times' concern for the dead. The attention paid to the people who were important to him are no longer with him on the journey through earthly life. In a certain sense, the gestures of affection and love which surround the deceased are a way to protect him in the conviction that they will have an effect on the judgment. This we can gather from the majority of cultures that characterize the history of man. Today, the world has become, at least in appearance, much more rational, or rather, there is a more widespread tendency to think that every reality ought to be tackled with the criteria of experimental science, and that the great questions about death ought to be answered not so much with faith as with empirical, provable knowledge. It is not sufficiently taken into account, however, that precisely in this way one is doomed to fall into forms of spiritism, in an attempt to have some kind of contact with the world beyond, almost imagining it to be a reality that ultimately is a copy of the present one. Dear friends, the Solemnity of All Saints and the Commemoration of All the Faithful Departed tells us that only those who can recognize a great hope in death can live a life based on hope. If we reduce man exclusively to his horizontal dimension, to that which we can be perceived empirically, life itself loses its profound meaning. Man needs eternity, for every other hope is too brief, too limited for him. Man can be explained only if there is a love which overcomes every isolation, even that of death, in a totality which also transcends time and space. Man can be explained, he finds his deepest meaning, only if there is God, and we know that God left his distance for us and made himself close. He entered into our lives and tells us, and he's quoting John 11:25-26, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Think for a moment on the scene at Calvary and listen again to Jesus' words from the height of the cross addressed to the criminal crucified on his right. Luke 23:24-43. Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. We think of the two disciples on the road to Emmaus, when, after traveling a stretch of the way with the risen Jesus, they recognize him and set out immediately for Jerusalem to proclaim the resurrection of the Lord. That's from Luke 24. The Master's words come back to our minds with renewed clarity. Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house there are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you that I go to prepare. Would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? That's from John 14. And here's his conclusion. God is truly demonstrated. He became accessible, for he so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. That's John 3:16. And in the supreme act of love on the cross, immersing himself in the abyss of death, he conquered it and rose and opened the doors of eternity for us too. Christ sustains us through the night of death, which he himself overcame. He is the good shepherd on whose guidance one can rely without any fear, for he knows the way well, even through the darkness. Every Sunday in reciting the Creed, we affirm this truth, and in going to cemeteries to pray with affection and love for our departed, we are invited once more to renew with courage and with strength our faith in eternal life, indeed to live with this great hope and to bear witness to it in the world. Behind the present, there is not nothing. And faith in eternal life gives to Christians the courage to love our earth ever more intensely, and to work in order to build a future for it, and to give it a true and sure hope. That is beautiful. Cyrus will get a link posted to it for you, if you're interested in reading it or sharing it. I wish I knew the source of which of his books or addresses that might have come from. Unfortunately, that's not put there, but the words certainly do ring true for me. I hope they do for you. And this is a reminder that during this period of time right now, within 8 days of November the 1st, if you want to gain a plenary indulgence for the souls of those who have passed on, you can do that. Go to Mass and confession, pray the prayers for the intentions of the Pope, be free from all attachment to sin, and just simply visit a cemetery and say some prayers for the repose of the souls of those who have departed. It's that simple. And you can apply this plenary indulgence to the deceased loved ones that you have in mind. Could be all of your family members, could be a specific family member, could be a friend, could be a deceased husband or wife, child, what have you. This is one of those things that is so often overlooked in the life of the church nowadays anyway. It used to be that indulgences were far more commonly known about, and you'd see, for example, at the bottom of a holy card, I remember seeing this when I was a kid, 300 days indulgence or 1 year indulgence. And I think most Catholics, I was one of them at that time anyway, thought that that meant, well, you get 300 days off purgatory, or you get 1 year off purgatory. And that's not what it means. It's not what it meant then. And this is one reason why the church revised the way in which indulgences are promulgated by simplifying it simply to just partial indulgence. And there's no set amount of penance that is remitted. And plenary indulgence, which means that all penance due to sin that has been forgiven throughout your life is being remitted. It's like setting your odometer over to zero again. And many people thought that meant this is 300 days out of purgatory. But rather, what it always meant, what it means now is this is the equivalent of if you had done penance for 300 days, whatever that may have been. And so now with this more streamlined understanding of what indulgences are, it seems to me that it's all the more reason why we should pay attention to them and avail ourselves of them. So just a reminder, following on after what Pope Benedict XVI said, that if you have time in your busy schedule and you can make a stop quickly at a cemetery near you, every town has one, just stop in and spend a few minutes praying for the repose of the souls who are there. And assuming that you fulfill the other requirements, you can gain a plenary indulgence each day between now and the 8th of November for your departed loved ones. And if you're interested, the book that I mentioned before, and naturally I don't have it here on my console here in the studio, but it is a book called Handbook of Indulgences, Norms and Grants. And it's published by Catholic Publishing Company. A little hardback book, rather elegant and plain looking, but it's packed with prayers and the church's requirements and everything you really need to know to be able to understand indulgences and to avail yourselves of them. So if you would like to get a book that you will hopefully use quite a bit, I would recommend that one. I have an email here that comes in from, where did it go? This comes in from Carol, who's listening in New Jersey. And she says, can you receive communion twice in one day? I went to Mass in the a.m. or the morning on a holy day of obligation, and then again in the evening because I wanted to take my daughter. Is it permissible to receive communion twice? Well, great question. The answer to that is yes. So in the Church's canon law, if you zero in on canon 917, here's what it says. A person who has already received the Most Holy Eucharist can receive it a second time on the same day, only within the Eucharistic celebration in which the person participates, without prejudice to the prescript of Canon 921, subsection 2. And I'll talk about that in a minute. So it says yes, but what it means here is that, let's say that you went to Mass that morning, you received Holy Communion, you can't go back and just receive Holy Communion independent of going to Mass again. So you need to receive Holy Communion. If you do a second time, it would have to be within the context of that Mass. Now, let me share a few more of these canons because they pertain to this bigger picture, and it might be helpful for people to know this. Starting with the next canon, 918, it is highly recommended that the faithful receive Holy Communion during the Eucharistic celebration itself. It is to be administered outside of Mass, however, to those who request it for a just cause, with the liturgical rites being observed. So, in my own case, there have been instances where I have gone, for example, to go give a major talk somewhere at a church, let's say, and I felt the desire to have fortification. I wasn't able to get to Mass that morning, and I've, from time to time, asked the priest, would it be possible for me to receive Holy Communion before I give this talk? And the priest would say yes, and there would be, you know, some time for preparation, maybe a few minutes, and then you can receive Holy Communion that way. But the norm, of course, and the desire of the Church is to receive Holy Communion, ideally, during the Mass itself. A person who is to receive the Most Holy Eucharist is to abstain for at least 1 hour before Holy Communion from any food or drink except for only water and medicine. Now, I have, I've printed out, and I don't know if I have it available to share with you right now, but a canon lawyer's kind of a proposal that the Church reinstate the 3 hour fast before receiving Holy Communion. That's what it was from the time of from when Pope Pius XII established this. Prior to that, it was from midnight on. Those of you who are old enough to remember that, you'll remember this is why everybody went to Mass early on Sunday morning or early the following morning if it was a weekday or a Saturday, because the prior discipline, which was in place for many, many centuries, was that you couldn't receive Holy Communion unless you had fasted from midnight on, and fasting from food and drink. I mean, you could have a little water. And even that, I suppose, there may have been a question about that. But naturally, you can have medicine if you need it, but you couldn't consume any food. So naturally, people who had been following this fast from midnight the night before, they wanted to go to Mass as early as possible so that they could eat. They wanted to break their fast, break fast. But it was reduced to 3 hours, under Pope Pius XII, and then again it was reduced to simply 1 hour before receiving Holy Communion. So I don't know. Maybe we'll live to see that change again. I think it would be a good thing, and it would be a great way for you and me to intensify our devotion to the Holy Eucharist, and it would involve a little bit of suffering, just a teensy bit of suffering, not a whole lot. I mean, you can go 3 hours without a bite to eat. And now, I'm not talking about if you're hypoglycemic or if you have some other medical issue. Just the average person can get through 3 hours without a bite to eat. And even if you feel a little hunger gnawing at your belly, that's a good thing, because it's a way to enter into the spirit of Christ's sacrifice with a little sacrifice of your own. Continuing, after being initiated into the Most Holy Eucharist, each of the faithful is obliged to receive Holy Communion at least once a year. This precept must be fulfilled during the Easter season unless it is fulfilled for a just cause at another time during the year. You're not obliged to go to communion every day. You're not obliged to go to communion every Sunday. You are obliged to go to Mass every Sunday. That's what we call the Sunday obligation. And unless you have some extenuating circumstance that is legitimate, not just that you don't feel good or I'm kind of tired this morning, that's not a legitimate reason to refrain from going to Mass on Sunday. But let's say your child's in the hospital and you have to be there, well, that's a legitimate reason. Or let's say that you're flat on your back with a bad flu, or you're recovering from a medical procedure, or I use this example all the time, you're an OBGYN and you have to deliver a baby on Sunday morning. Those are legitimate examples of where you would be, you know, your duty would be dispensed, if that's the right word for it, or commuted. So in any case, if you go to Mass on Sunday, ideally, hopefully, you're receiving Holy Communion. Receive Holy Communion as often as possible. Remember that you have to be in the state of grace. So if you haven't gone to confession and you have some mortal sins on your soul, go to confession first so that you're in the state of grace to receive Holy Communion. Canon 921 says, the Christian faithful who are in danger of death from any cause are to be nourished by Holy Communion in the form of viaticum. Viaticum is a Latin word that means to go with, as in, this is food for your journey, Christ is going with you. Even if they have been nourished by Holy Communion on the same day, however, those in danger of death are strongly urged to receive communion again. So if your grandfather is dying in the hospital and he received Holy Communion that day, and by evening time, let's say, he's still alive and he's still in danger of death, he can receive Holy Communion again. Holy Viaticum for the sick is not to be delayed too long. Those who have care of souls, that would be the priest primarily, are to be zealous and vigilant that the sick are nourished by Viaticum while fully conscious. The Christian faithful can participate in the Eucharistic sacrifice and receive Holy Communion in any Catholic rite without prejudice to the prescript of Canon 844. Now, that's referring to, let's say, you're a Latin Rite Catholic, like I am, and you go to a Byzantine Rite church. It's part of the Catholic Church. It's going to look different. It's going to seem different, but it's still just as Catholic as you and I are. It's just one of the rites of the church that you're not familiar with. So if you go to that rite, you can receive Holy Communion. You can attend their divine liturgy. This is what they call the Mass. And you have the freedom to do that without changing the rite, R-I-T-E. As I've mentioned before, Nancy and I did this for 3 years running at a Ruthenian Byzantine parish, and we absolutely loved it. We learned a great deal, and it was very refreshing and helpful for us, but we never gave any thought to changing rites. You can do that too if you want to. Sometimes that's done as a result of marrying somebody who is a member of that rite. But even though it is possible and easy, in fact, to change rites if that's something you want to do. I'm not recommending it, but it's not easy to change back. In fact, it can be nigh unto impossible to change back. If you go that direction, then you say, uh-oh, I'd rather go back where I was. Going back in the other direction is not nearly so easy. We'll take a break. We'll get to phone calls on the other side of this. My number again, 888-914-9149. I've got some news about Justice Amy Coney Barrett, something that people are unhappy with her about once again. And I don't think they should be. I'll be right back with more right after this. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Hey, guess what, Cyrus?
What's that?
I'm not going to tell you the backstory about this song. So don't even ask me.
Wow.
I know.
But I'm getting my calendar.
I know. Put a mark on the calendar. 888-914-9149. How about George now in San Diego? Good morning, George.
So this is my question. I went to Mass this past Sunday.
Okay.
And I was in line to receive communion on the deacon side.
Okay.
And Father was at the right, facing deacon. So I was the last person. And on the Father's side, the line ended. So Father called me. And I went up to receive communion. And I opened my mouth, but the Father asked me to receive the communion in the hand. He basically said, in the hand, please. And I said, in the tongue. And he said, again, in the hand. My question was, would I have committed a sin or would I have been out of line if I would have refused communion from Father? I mean,
no.
I don't want to walk in the line of pride, you know, and I also didn't want to embarrass him or embarrass myself because I did feel embarrassed.
Yeah, this is so unnecessary, but I'm not a pastor of the church. The bishops are, and this is not for me to, you know, to make these determinations. So the bishop has the competence to make those decisions. I may not agree with them, but, you know, they are what they are. So, no, to answer your question, no, you would not have been committing a sin. If you, in your heart, feel that it's your desire to receive Jesus on the tongue, you have that right. In fact, the church has always said that you have this right in documents about the Holy Eucharist and in other forms. And it was only really until COVID that that became a subject of contention because there were some who really, 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 really didn't want anyone to receive communion on the tongue anymore. And they, I think, in some cases, that it was a pretext that was convenient to use, COVID, that is, to prevent people from receiving Holy Communion on the tongue because they just don't like the traditional form of it. I'm not saying that's true in general, but I think for some it was. So it was a convenient way to just stop people in their tracks from receiving Holy Communion. But this is no longer an issue, hasn't been for some time now, and we've gotten back to normal, and we shake hands and we, you know, touch things that other people have touched, and nobody's dropping dead of COVID. So on the one hand, it strikes me as so unfortunate that some people persist in doing something that's no longer, even if it ever was necessary to begin with, which is a debatable question. But to your point, it's an unfortunate situation. And if you had decided not to receive Holy Communion in the hand, no, you would not have been committing a sin. It's always unfortunate, to use the term again, when you have an opportunity to receive Holy Communion and you don't for whatever reason. But you have to follow your conscience. And if in your conscience you truly believe that it would be better for you to receive communion on the tongue, knowing that this is not a matter of committing a sin, if you received Holy Communion in the hand, I don't recommend it, but the church says you can do it. So I guess I'm sort of re-answering your question several times over, but no, you would not.
I mean, I'm sorry, I've always received communion in the tongue. I'm sorry, didn't mean to cut you off, Patrick.
It's okay.
But the deacon was giving communion in the tongue. That's what made it kind of saddening, upset, embarrassing at the same time, because Father was giving in the hand, but deacon was given in the tongue, or the option.
Yeah.
And that's what, yeah, that was my question, basically. And
well, I understand
it. Any more of the time.
No, it's okay. Well, don't forget, George, I'm here. This is what I do. My time is your time.
Thank you.
So I'm here for you.
All right.
I always wonder why people feel so bashful about taking up time. That's what we're here to do. And I mean that in a positive way, George. Please never feel like, you know, you're intruding on something here, because that's why I'm here.
I could understand.
I really can understand. And I really don't know what to say other than I'm sorry that it happened. It's unfortunate. It's unnecessary.
No,
I wish that it weren't that way. But hey, you know what? This is the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church is a lot like Noah's Ark. Noah's Ark was a very messy, unpleasant place to be. I'm sure it stank to high heaven. I'm sure it was very difficult to get a good night's sleep on Noah's Ark. But boy, oh boy, aren't you glad you're on Noah's Ark during the flood? I'd rather be on the Ark than not on the Ark. So I feel this way. I can put up with the bad night's sleep and the tossing of the waves and the smell and the noise and all that, because I'd rather be on the ark than not on the ark. So I think the best thing to do is stiff upper lip, say a prayer for all involved. Thank you, Jesus, for being present in the Holy Eucharist, and go forward. That's what I would do. Don't get angry.
No, yeah. No, absolutely not. No, and I'm not even judging the priest. I'm, like I said, I just, I bless him, and he's got to have it tough, but yeah, give him the benefit of the doubt, like you say. Well, thank you, Patrick.
You got it. Thank you, George. Always here for you. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Brandon in Chicago. Hi, Brandon.
Hi, Patrick. How's it going? I have a question about Mary, but I wanted to comment on the last commentator.
Yeah.
I went to a parish when I tried to receive communion in the mouth while I was holding my child, and they were refusing to put it in my mouth and tried cramming it in my hand. Mm-hmm. And I insisted that they put it in my mouth, and the lady scoffed and shoved it in my mouth. And I was like, what are we doing?
I know. It's these crazy... It's where they... Don't get me started, but I guess I already am started. Can you, you know, if you're there to distribute communion, just distribute Holy Communion. That's what your job is. You're not there to police other people's piety. You're not there to impose your own views on what people should or shouldn't do. Just do your job. That's what you're there for. And the church from time immemorial has permitted, and for the longest time, you know, required communion on the tongue. It was only recently that communion on the hand made a comeback from the time that it was present in the early church. But we should respect that. And so, once again, I'm sorry to hear that you had to go through that. I've been through similar situations myself. And all you can do, like I was talking with George a moment ago, is say a prayer for that person, you know, and just move forward, because it's likely that you can't really change somebody's mind if they're that entrenched in their ideology that they're going to be acting out this way against people when they should be distributing Holy Communion. Anyway, those are my thoughts, Brandon. So please proceed, sir.
So, yes. So somebody brought something to my attention that actually has alarmed me a little bit in regards to Mary. They brought up that from like the Vatican documents, the Vatican Collection Volume 1, Vatican Council 2, on the Virgin Mary. And it says that when Mary is the subject of preaching and worship, she prompts the faithful to come to her son. Now, the way that that is worded, I don't know how to take that. Is it saying that she is a subject of worship, or is that just saying in the context of worship when she is, you know, the centerpiece or being represented? I don't know what that means, when she is a subject of preaching and worship.
Yeah, so I don't have that in front of me, so I can't quote it verbatim. It would take me a while to look that up, but I'm sure that this is the language that is used. Two things I want to say. Number one is subject and object. So if the text actually reads that she's the subject, it would not refer to her being worshipped, because the one who is worshipped is the object of worship. And so that would be one thing to say. And I'd have to look at the text itself just to see what is said. But if indeed it says that she's the subject of worship, well, then she's the one who's doing the worshiping of God and encouraging us to do the same. Now, if it is used in a more archaic sense, then the way to understand it would be not that we are worshiping Mary. Of course, the church forbids the worshiping of anything other than God. But the word worship is used in a more archaic sense to mean to petition or to request. So, you know, even in England, for example, in the olden days, I guess, they would refer to people of higher status as your worship. They might address a judge in a courtroom as your worship, or a king or some other person of high status as your worship. Now, that is not used anymore in English. And so by the time we have the Second Vatican Council in the mid-1960s, it may be that in the translation from the Latin into English that they adopted that more archaic form. Similarly, you know how in more archaic English we would say, I pray thee, tell me, where is the local post office? And in the former language for the sacrament of holy matrimony, the phraseology was used as, with my body I thee worship. And the term worship there means to honor. We've since changed that word from worship to honor. And we don't even say that phrase anymore in the church's sacramentary, but it was very customary in Christendom for a long time. With my body, I thee worship. With my body, I thee honor would be now the more modern way to say it. But it doesn't involve adoration or worship, which a creature gives only to God. So I'll have to just say that on the basis of what you're telling me. I'd need to look at it more closely to find out more.
So it does
on the
say,
face of it.
So it does say the word subject and not object. Can you just explain that point just one more time when you were talking about the word subject and object?
Okay, sure. So if you are, let's say we're talking about, if we're talking about God and worship of God, God is the object of our worship. You are the subject of the worship because you're the person, you're the subject who's doing the worshiping. And who are you worshiping? Where is your worship going toward? What is the object of your worship? That would be God. So subject, object in this case is the person doing the action is the subject and the person receiving the action is the object in this kind of a context.
Okay, that clears it up. Okay, uh-huh. That I feel better about that.
Yeah, and the thing to remember
Thank
too
you.
Is that if it's referring to, and how did you put it that Mary is the subject of worship or the subject
when
of
she,
preaching?
It says, Mary in a way unites in her person, blah, blah, blah. And when she is the subject of preaching and worship, she prompts the faithful to come to her son, to his sacrifice and to the love of the Father.
Okay. So that to me seems easy to parse out, and that is that when the priest is preaching, let's say, a sermon, and it involves Mary. So let's say it's in the context of divine worship, which would be the Mass, and the sermon topic happens to touch upon, say, Luke chapter 1, the Annunciation. So she's the subject of the sermon because he's talking about her. He's talking about what the angel said to her. And it's also the subject of worship because it's taking place within a liturgical context in the case of worshiping God. That's what it's referring to. It doesn't mean that Mary is the object of worship because how could she be? She's a creature. And she doesn't,
right.
You know. St. John made that mistake in the book of Revelation. And he is so overcome by the angel and the power of the angel that we're told that he falls down and worships the angel. And the angel says, get up, don't do that. I am just a creature. Worship God, not me. So the Catholic Church has always taught that, even though from time to time we can run into archaic use of words, or in this case, maybe more precise use of words that can be confusing of people or thinking that it means something other than it does.
That actually brings me a lot of peace of mind, Patrick. Thank you for explaining that to me.
You're most welcome. Well, it's an important topic, to be sure, so I'm glad I can help you with that. And if you want to send me an email with the info, you can send me an email. I mean, if you want to, by going to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, and click on Connect. And then if you wanted to send me the documentation, I'd be more than happy to take a look at it. And if necessary, amplify or embellish anything I said, but I'd like to see it just to know exactly what was said. Thanks, Brendan. Great talking to you. How about Joseph in Minneapolis? Good morning, Joseph.
Yeah.
Hey, Joseph.
Right, thank you.
You're welcome. Joseph isn't ready. All right, maybe Joseph will be ready. How about we take a break and we'll circle back to Joseph right after this, and we have several other people who are waiting. One or two lines are open. You can get it by calling 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back right after this. Relevant Radio runs on horsepower. Your horsepower. Donate any vehicle and keep our stations running. Join in with hundreds of other listeners who have donated their used vehicles at relevantradio.com/car.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
I told you I had some Amy Coney Barrett news. This is from the Washington Examiner. Penguin Random House is sticking with Justice Amy Coney Barrett and her book deal. The publisher took a lot of heat from more than 600 writers, editors, and literary workers, blah, 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 who called in and called for them to cancel the deal. They wrote an open letter citing concerns over her vote to overturn Roe v.ersus Wade, blah, blah, blah. The letter claimed the call wasn't a form of censorship. Oh, no, they would never do that. But rather out of concern for wider and more social responsibilities. Uh-huh. They said, we remain fully committed to publishing authors who, like Justice Barrett, substantively shape today's most important conversations. This, thankfully, was the response from Adrian Zackheim with The Sentinel, which is an imprint of Penguin Random House. Let's see. Sentinel publishes books so that people can read them and evaluate them on their own. In an intelligent, free society, we need to disseminate ideas in a robust form so that we can discuss them. Yes. But by the way, that's heresy to a great swath of humanity in these United States nowadays, because if they disagree with your ideas, they will shout you down so that you can't express your ideas. That's what this is all about. This is exactly a form of censorship. Zackheim noted that Sentinel, which is this imprint, is honored to publish a book by a sitting Supreme Court justice and said it will be available likely in 2024. As of Tuesday afternoon, the letter from all the complainers had 639 signatures. Shut up and sit down is my response. That's what I would have written back. Shut up and sit down. No, I'm not going to cancel the contract for a sitting Supreme Court justice just because you personally don't like the decision that she was part of. Tough luck. Next, 888-914-9149. Let's go to Joseph. We'll try him again in Minneapolis. Good morning, Joseph.
Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning. I apologize.
I'm sorry.
No problem. Nope. Don't be sorry. It was actually kind of humorous. You were busy helping somebody. So,
well, 5% of my time in the workday is with a customer. I do delivery work. So wouldn't you know, after I was on hold that most of the time I'm ready to go and it worked that way. I apologize.
I know how it is. Don't worry about it.
My question is kind of a follow-up question to something that I heard you teach before, and that we as Catholics are not to to sell things that have been blessed, which makes great sense. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just wondering, is it somehow different when a person has their home blessed, or sometimes parishes will have a blessing of the cars and things like this? And I'm just wondering, where's the disconnect on that?
Yeah, that is a very good question. And the answer is that, obviously, if you've ever had your house blessed, I've had my houses blessed many times. Houses in terms of the house I lived in before this one, this house, etc. So you can sell your house. the church has a law. I'm just thinking, it's not funny what you're asking, but I'm just thinking about how funny it would be if it were taken to that extreme. The church has a law that you can't traffic in blessed items. So let's say, and not just blessed items, but just holy items in general. So you can't traffic in relics. You can't traffic in blessings or other things like that. And for articles that have been blessed that are, say, like a rosary or something like that, it's more the sense that you should not presume to sell something because it's holy. Hey, I've got this blessed article. I'm going to charge you $10 more for it. And one of the biblical bases of this is what's known as simony from Simon Magus, who was a magician who importuned the apostles and said, I'd love to do what you guys can do by way of miracles and things. How do you do that? I'll pay you. Can you just show me how you do what you do? And so the term simony, which is a sin if it involves trafficking and such things, comes from him. It's in the book of Acts. And so they basically shut him down and said, we can't sell this to you. This is from God. You can't buy anything like this. So in the case of a car that you have had blessed, or your home that you've had blessed, things like that, those indeed can be sold, because it doesn't fit within the church's requirement that you not traffic in things that are blessed. But on the other hand, if you're setting up shop in selling, let's say, blessed rosaries, and you're selling them because they're blessed, well, no, you really can't do that. And one way that groups get around that, and I don't think it's a bad thing, really, is they just say, suggest a donation. If you want to make a donation, you can make a suggested amount, or any amount for that matter. That's one way to go about doing it. Blessed candles, for example. So you go into church and you can make a donation in the offering box to cover the cost of the candle because the parish had to pay for the candle. But if it's a blessed candle, it's a blessed candle. So you're not, they're technically not selling it. You're technically not buying it. You're just offering a donation. That's what the church's laws about simony tend to focus on. It can get to other things too, like buying and selling ecclesiastical offices. Hey, you want to be a bishop? Great. $100,000 and we'll make sure you're a bishop. That too would fall under the ban of the sin of simony. But to sell your house that's been blessed or to sell your car that's been blessed, that doesn't fall under that.
This raises another question, which didn't even occur to me until first of all, thank you for your answer.
Sure.
And this is sort of getting into the weeds and a peculiar question at that. And the last thing it is, believe me, is intended to be a gotcha mm-hmm. kind of a question. But as Catholics, and I'm sure it would make us all sad, but it made me think of a few years back, there is a Catholic church in our diocese in St. Paul that was closed, and I believe it was I'm sure there was a transaction, so to speak, a business transaction, but it is now a mosque.
Mm-hmm.
And
how sad.
That would be a very holy place.
mm-hmm. Yeah, what happens in that instance, Joseph, and this is governed by the church's law as well, is that a church that is going to no longer be used as a church is formally, officially deconsecrated. And there's a formal liturgical rite that the bishop typically would undertake that would formally deconsecrate it so that it was no longer set aside for that use, in which case then it could be sold or given away. What a shame that it's turned into a mosque. I understand.
Yeah.
I've read about things like this, but that would be how the church would handle something like that.
Okay.
And to give you another example, as long as we're at it, if you can stand a little bit more, Joseph. If a church is desecrated, the church's law also extends to something like this. If the church is desecrated, let's say there's a murder that takes place in a church or some other kind of heinous action. Let's say that Satanists break in and perform a black mass or something like that. The same thing would happen. Somewhat the same thing would happen. The church would have to be reconsecrated because if it was profaned in various ways, then the church would no longer be used for mass until it had been formally reconsecrated. That's another permutation there.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're most welcome. I appreciate that. Keep on keeping on. Let's go now to Solange in Gilbert, Arizona. Good morning, Solange.
Morning, Patrick. I have a question for you. I'm just wondering why a lay person can distribute the communion, not just the priest and the deacon. So I am Lebanese, and I was born and grew up in a Maronite church,
uh-huh.
and you don't see it in our church. So when I first came here like about 16 years ago, and we went to an American church, a Catholic American church, I was surprised, and I wasn't sure if it's okay to go and get the communion from those people, not just go to the priest.
Yeah, very good question. So in the Maronite rite, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, Solange, doesn't the priest at communion, doesn't he dip the sacred host into the chalice of the precious blood when he gives communion? Is that a custom?
Right, yes.
I've seen it done there. Okay.
Right, yes.
Okay, so that, and by the way, that's known as intinction you're in the Catholic Church too, in the Latin rite of the Catholic Church. You don't see it very often, but I think it's a good thing. In any case, the Latin rite of the Catholic Church permits lay people to distribute Holy Communion, and they're known as extraordinary ministers, meaning, if you want to use church speak here, that the ordinary minister of this sacrament is the priest or a deacon and certainly a bishop. But in extraordinary circumstances, and there are two ways that this word ordinary and extraordinary can be understood. One is in an ecclesiastical sense, like the bishop is the ordinary of a diocese. He is the bishop of a diocese. So there's a certain connotation of that word in that regard, but it also extends to maybe a more colloquial way of saying in extraordinary circumstances when there are far too many people for one priest or two priests or a priest and a deacon to reasonably distribute Holy Communion in a time frame that wouldn't be excessively long, the pastor, the priest, can request the assistance of lay people who would help distribute Holy Communion. They are known as extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion. Unfortunately, in this country, it has gone so far to the end of the spectrum where now, I mean, I've been in any number of situations at Mass where there, you know, maybe one priest and 25 people, and they call up extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion. It's completely unnecessary. And one of the things that was done, one of the reasons for this, by the way, was this, in my view, misguided notion that because the church wants lay people to be more involved and to participate more in the Mass, that, hey, here's one thing we can give them to do, have them distribute Holy Communion. And that's unfortunate because it helps to blur a line of distinction between the sacrament of holy orders and the men who have that sacrament and lay people. And this is, in an odd way, in an ironically odd way, it's a way of kind of clericalizing lay people. Completely unnecessary some of the time. Sometimes it is necessary. So at a parish where you've got maybe 1,000 people or some large number of people and you have one priest or a priest and a deacon, it's not unreasonable for the priest to say, please, you, come and help us distribute Holy Communion. Sometimes it takes an exaggerated form where maybe 10 people come up to distribute Holy Communion, and that slows everything down. And oddly enough, it takes a whole long time for all those people to get up there and then for them to receive communion and then to have the ciboriums distributed to them. Long story short, there is a legitimate time and place for lay people to distribute Holy Communion if it's necessary. Ideally, it should be the priest or a deacon, for that matter. And in the case of the priest, more specifically, because when the priest is ordained to the priesthood and receives the sacrament of holy orders at that level, his hands are consecrated by the bishop for the purpose of offering sacrifice at the altar and for handling the most precious body and blood of Jesus. My hands are not consecrated. Your hands are not consecrated. The deacon's hands, for that matter, are also not consecrated in a diaconate ordination. So I'm going to leave the deacons off to the side because they have a special ministry at the altar. But we lay people don't. This is not our job. This is not our duty unless there's some necessity for us to help. So it is what it is. And in the United States, it was like the Oklahoma land rush. From Vatican II on, it just became the thing now. And so almost everywhere you go, this is what you're going to see, I'm sorry to say. But the church permits it. And so I don't want to overexplain it, but that's what you're going to see indefinitely. And maybe I missed something along the way. Did I answer it, or was there anything more you wanted to ask about?
No, you answered my question. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you. How about Nora, whom I'm told is 7 years old? Nora in Aberdeen, North Carolina. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello. Are you 7 years old?
Yeah.
Well, welcome to the program, Nora. Did you have a question for me?
Yeah, two.
Okay, all right. Go for it.
My first question is, who is the first saint?
Who is the first saint? Well, let's see. I think the very, very first saint was Abel. And you read about him in the book of Genesis. It's the first book in the Bible. He was one of Adam and Eve's sons. And your mom can share the story with you. But I think if you want to talk about the very, 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 very first human being who was a saint, I think it was Abel. In fact, if you listen carefully, when the priest at Mass is is celebrating the Holy Eucharist, you'll sometimes, depending on which prayer he's using, you'll hear the name Abel mentioned. Abel the Just, he's called. Now, if we're talking about from the time of Jesus forward, then I think we could safely say that the very first saint was the Blessed Virgin Mary. So if you're talking about from when Jesus was incarnated, it would be Mary. What was your second question?
My second question was, why did Saint Michael fight the devil?
Why did he fight the devil? Because when the devil rebelled against God, and all the bad angels rebelled against God, God allowed the good angels to drive them away, to push them away. And so that's what that fight was all about. Saint Michael and the good angels were driving the bad angels away. Oh, I wish we had more time, Nora, but thank you. I appreciate the call. I'll be right back.